assignments. What was due today? Today's the 22nd, right? So the revised cover page, revised design constraints and project schedule, right? Is that correct? I'm seeing blank faces. Why don't we put the computer terminals down? Since a lot of people are, you won't really need those today. So I'm seeing some looks of surprise. So did we get this done or what? Yes, no. The mechanical engineer, talking about mechanical engineering, yeah. But the other.
Yeah, I can't really speak for that.
Okay, well, let's keep, you know, we need to keep moving. So the midterm presentations are next week, right? So how many of you have met with your advisor last week? How many teams have met with? We have a lot of people missing today. What? How many teams have met with their advisor last week? One. Okay. And how many of you plan to meet with your advisor before the presentation next week? All right. Good. Good. We were at our coordinators meeting this morning. We were talking about the fact that some of the Senior Design 2 teams that are struggling, are part of the reason they're struggling is they're not meeting with their advisor regularly, and there's sort of finger-pointing going on. The advisor says the team's not engaged. The team says the advisor's not answering their questions, and it's kind of a bad situation, but that does happen if you pick the wrong advisor or the wrong team or the wrong project. Any other issues we need to deal with? So the presentations on next week will be at the Student Activity Center. Does everybody know where the Student Activity Center is? We had a few lost souls, including faculty. We had faculty. I used the SAC for the first time last year. We had faculty that didn't even know where the SAC was. And I've only been here a year. You know, this is my year and a half. And we had faculty who'd been here 10, 20 years who didn't know where the SAC was. I thought that was kind of interesting. But we're on the second floor of the SAC. The rooms, your presentations are scheduled for a particular room. And please try to attend as many of the other presentations as possible, because that's one of the ways you learn, is you see how other people present material and things they do well, things they don't do well, that kind of thing. We will not, for the final presentations, we'll videotape those, but for these ones, we won't. So these are more like internal reviews. Any questions about that, or?
When do we get those posted for like 9 tomorrow?
It's on the web. I sent an email. I sent it a week ago or so. It's on the it's under the schedules link on the website.
Okay.
Okay. And aren't you getting email from 4196 Alias? Listserv?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe I missed that one.
Okay.
I think I got that.
Really?
I'll check right now.
We can always go to all the emails are archived, so you can always go to the archives and search for them as well if you ever need to find anything. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about today was, this will be the first part of a two-part lecture. The second part will come in Senior Design 2, but for Today I want to talk a little bit about standards and a little bit about testing and how these really play into your senior design projects. And then in second semester, we'll talk a little more specifically about testing, about how to write test specifications and things. Even though you'll do some of that this semester, we'll deal with that more in depth next semester, because next semester you'll actually be building and testing your system. So today I just wanted to really introduce the notion of standards and testing, and why these two are so closely related. So as an example of this, we have a picture of a safety shoe. So let's say you want to go into the business of making safety shoes. What's that business going to, what are some of the parameters of that business?
Shoes have to be safe.
Okay, and what does that mean?
Safety.
Why?
Depends on what it's going to be. Like, if we're making like fire safe shoes, or water safe shoes, water tight shoes, or depends on what standard you're making.
Do all shoes have to be safe? Can you sell safety shoes that are not necessarily safe? What's the difference between a shoe that is claimed, purported to be safe, but does not meet safety standards, and a shoe that actually meets safety standards? What's the probably the most striking difference between those two? In cost, right? If you've ever shopped for these things, you'll see the kind of generics that look like work boots and all that, and then you'll see the ones that actually carry the safety certifications. Why do you think there's a big difference in price? Do you think it's the actual construction of the shoe? In some sense, it's the construction of the shoe, but mostly it's the cost incurred in gaining that approval, the legal risk you're taking in carrying that approval, and then the feeling also that you can, customers are willing to spend more money for those kinds of shoes. So where do you then, so then you realize, okay, if I'm going to be in the safety shoe business, I need to pay attention to some safety standards. And that's part of what this talk is about, because many of your senior design projects should really be governed by some of these standards. And we want to talk today a little bit about that. And then we'll talk about how you actually test for these things. So when I made up this presentation about a year ago, Avatar just came out. And we were having a discussion about design constraints. And I actually, kind of to my surprise, found this discussion. It's a true story that, and I don't know if we have any Avatar fans here. I never actually saw the movie, but apparently there's this material, unobtainium, and the way it came about was they were, in writing the script actually for the movie, they needed a material that kind of, magical material that obeyed any design constraints, so they coined this term in an early script writing session. They didn't intend it to be the final term, they just were putting it as a placeholder, and apparently it stuck and I'd made it into the movie. But it's a nice little example of, you know, the challenge of design constraints. You will often find design constraints are conflicting, and you have to sort all that out. And unfortunately, you can't invoke magical materials like unobtainium to solve your senior design problems. So standards generally go unnoticed. They're mostly quiet, unseen forces such as specifications, regulations, and protocols that ensure that things work properly, interactively, and responsibly. When you pick up the power supply for your laptop and turn it over, what do you see on the bottom? What? You see a whole bunch of labels. There's like 12 of them on there just for the power supply. And they all have various standards organizations behind them. But you never really notice these things. As long as your power supply works, everyone's happy, Of course, when your house burns down because your power supply blew up and started a fire, that's when you worry about all these stickers that are on the back, because these are people you're going to sue, or people that are going to be problems if you try to sue. So standards generally go unnoticed until something bad happens. And then standards become really important, because more than likely the design engineers are going to say, well, we designed that product to meet all the available safety standards or all the available standards, and the fact that you got killed using that product is just your bad luck. And of course, you as a consumer or your family's not going to quite see it that way. So as engineers, we have to pay attention to these things, because these are really important when you really get into the very subtleties of whether a product worked or not, or whether a product violated patents and these kinds of things. But one of the things you may not know is that many of you in your engineering careers are going to be involved in the formation of standards. How standards come about is a mystery to most people, should they even ponder the question. That's a quote from the Office of Technology. As junior engineers, you will probably not be involved in this directly, but as mid-career engineers, you will more than likely spend some time working on standards. Now, why might you be interested in working on standards? Sort of in a kind of humorous way. There's a very compelling reason why you want to actually do some of this work at some time in your career that you may not realize. So I like to point these things out so you're prepared. What are some of the major standards organizations in the world?
FDA.
The
FDA.
FDA? FCC? Where are they located? Iowa? Washington, right? Okay. What else? ITU, in telecommunications and computer. Where's ITU located? Geneva, Switzerland. When you have these kinds of standards activities, you must travel to have meetings about these things. And these meetings are usually in very nice places. And you get to travel at the expense of your company. And you get to spend often a lot of time at these meetings. So you're going to see a lot of your upper managers are going to love to be involved in these things, because they get to travel to all sorts of cool places. On top of actually going to the standards meetings, you will get to travel to conferences where they discuss these standards. The conferences are also in nice places. So you'll notice, you'll observe when you graduate, there are people in your company who are really heavily involved in this kind of stuff. They're never in the office, they're always traveling. And they do important work, because it's important from a company point of view to be involved in the formation of these standards. But for you as engineers, you'll see it does involve an opportunity to travel, an opportunity to network with people. It's a good way to kind of get outside of your company and learn something and be involved in something. Now, why as a company are you interested in the formation of standards? Why is your company willing to send you to Hawaii for 2 weeks to have a standards meeting? And if you haven't figured out, by the way, one of the reasons you should get engineering degrees is because you get to travel a lot at the expense of your company. And if you like to travel, you'll be able to see the world on somebody else's money, which is really nice. It's one of the fringe benefits of being an engineer. But why as a company are you interested in standards? And this is a very important issue. So name me a standard that's influenced your life. There's any number of standards that influence your life on a daily basis. Okay, water quality is a good one. Why should you be interested in water quality? So I was never thought much about water quality. I lived in Chicago for many years, which claims to have the world's best water. Then I moved to Dallas, which also had good water. Then I moved to Mississippi. I lived on a farm in Mississippi, close to where I taught at Mississippi State. Where did I get my water from on my farm? No, I was not that stupid. I was not going to move on a farm that had well water. That was my next choice. That was what my wife did. We actually had bottled water delivered because my choice for water came from where? Who grew up in small town areas? Anyone here? So what kind? Where'd you get your water from?
We had a well.
You had a well?
Sewer.
Not quite the sewer. Though you would swear sometimes the way it tasted, it was the sewer. You tend to think that water is an industry dominated by like big cities and things, but a large chunk of the water in this country is delivered by ma and pa water associations. The water association that delivered my water in Mississippi was literally two people with only high school educations, and I wonder about that, who ran the local water company. And, you know, you realize pretty quickly that your life is in the hands of somebody who has no special training in water quality. Worse, every year they had to send you a report on water quality. Well, I'd never seen one of these reports before. I'm an electrical engineer. What do I know about this? So they send me this report and I start reading it, and what kinds of things do you find in these reports about water quality? And what kind of chemicals do they talk about? Not the healthy ones. All sorts of interesting stuff like cadmium and magnesium and stuff you wouldn't want to ingest. And do you think the numbers next to these quantities, you think they're zero? No. It's like, oh, you know, 0.06% cadmium or something, or 6 parts per million or whatever it is. And you start to wonder, I didn't know there was cadmium in my water. That's probably not a good thing. And, you know, and that's another good example of standards, that these organizations that run these small water companies have to be regulated in some way to make sure they don't kill people. So there are all sorts of regulations about water quality that they have to conform to, and laws and such. And in fact, part of their company is to actually have to receive training. So one of the little businesses our university ran was training all these ma and pa water shops on water quality and stuff. And that was a continuing ed type function that we ran. So that's a good example that if you want to be in the water business, you're going to be given a long list of things you have to conform to. But from a company point of view, let's talk more from the commerce side. Let's say you work for Sony or Google or any of these people. Why are you interested in putting your people on the standards committees?
You're setting the standards you need to follow.
You're able to influence the standard. Give me an example of a standard where there were battles in what standard was going to be adopted. I mean, this happens every so many years. What was one of the last major battlegrounds for standards?
Blu-ray.
What?
Blu-ray.
Good. Excellent. Versus what? So who were the part, you know, what were the two armies? Blu-ray was promoted by Sony and a few others, and whatever it was called, HD DVD or something, was promoted by Toshiba, right? And these companies put, everybody fights to get in their engineers on these standards committees, because then they can control how the standard's going to be created. So that's another reason your company will be very interested in you being very visible in these kinds of activities. And if you think it's all about science and it's all about objectivity, no. Standards committees are really political. And they, because the stakes are high with these particularly commercial standards. So what is a standard? It's a simplistic but idealized working definition. A standard, a document developed and used by consensus of the stakeholders, which describes how a product is to be obtained or used. The document can be electronic or paper. The stakeholders can be anyone in interest without restriction. The product can include hardware, software, analysis result, test results, protocol definition. Obtained or used can mean designed, built, procured, calculated, tested. So standards are actually pretty complicated. Even the simplest of standards are often backed up by documents that are this thick and go into tremendous amounts of detail about the standard, particularly about how you can test whether you conform to the standard. That's always a big issue, because when the day is done, you're going to want to put your sticker on your product that says you conform to a particular standard, somebody has to be responsible for certifying that. So the standard itself is not just a description of the water quality, for example. Maybe that's not the best case. The Blu-ray player, it's not just a description of the technology itself, but it's a description also of how you test that technology conforms. So often that'll involve, if you're dealing with digital data, you have to do certain digital tests, various test sequences and things to prove that you conform to that standard. And if you don't produce that, reproduce the data that as described in the standards document, you don't conform to the standard. So features of an ideal standard, relevant and necessary by providing specific value to benefit the development of a product, singular by focusing on a specific concept, unambiguous by not being subject to multiple interpretations, consistent by not conflicting with other documents within its family of standards, auditable, measurable. That's really key for senior design. You're focusing on measurable design constraints. Measurable with the quantitative exit criteria showing that the standard was followed. What do you think is involved in the process of actually demonstrating that you conform to a standard? So, for example, let's talk about a spec that you're very familiar with. Well, there's a couple good examples I like to talk about. One are UL specs, and one are EPA mileage ratings on cars. So what's involved with getting your new car design certified for EPA mileage? You design the car, you set up manufacturing, you build a production line, you roll a few models off that production line, you send those models to wherever the EPA is, and they drive those cars on the street and measure the mileage, right? That's what most consumers think EPA mileage test is all about, right?
Probably a specific scenario that they do for each test. Highway miles.
So how do you think they actually measure EPA mileage? The test is probably computer controlled. You're correct on that part. Do you think they actually send a fully assembled car? No. They just send the engine. When do they send that engine? Probably after they've done a few prototypes. Probably before they've even tried to ramp up the production line for it. They put the engine in a lab. They run a nice computer program that runs the engine through the paces. Out comes the number, and that's your EPA mileage. And then, of course, they put the disclaimer, this, you know, individual results may vary and all that kind of wonderful stuff. When you do a UL standard, like the power cords on your products, these computers and that are UL spec'd, what do you think you're going to do for that? You think you're going to do that test within your own laboratory? No. You're going to take your product to the UL. You're going to pay them a large sum of money. They're going to put it in their test lab, do the test, and report on the results. If you fail that test, you have to come back and pay more money to get it retested. And some of these processes can be rather complicated and expensive. A friend of mine used to do this for a company that he worked for, and he would go. His car was basically a mobile laboratory because he had. When we'd go bring his hardware for UL test for FCC testing, he'd have all sorts of spare parts in his car. He'd have, you know, electrical components, all this stuff, and he would actually sometimes have to fix the hardware on site because otherwise he would have to pay for another test, and the tests were about $15,000 a pop. So. They would try to get them done in one shot. So he used to have all these great stories about from the back of his trunk there trying to fix the hardware so it would pass the FCC testing. So what are some of the things that go into standards? Best practices. Good standards build on top of best practices. Where do best practices come from? They come from typically the committee sitting around and talking about what's worked for them and their products. That's another reason why you want to be involved in one of these committees. Lessons learned, recent research results, able to stimulate further research in related areas. What is a characteristic of a good standard? Give me an example of a standard that's been very successful. A standard that survived for a long time. A standard that affects your life every day when you're watching television or listening to the radio or any of these kinds of things. So within your lifetimes, you've seen a major change in the format of television, right? How long, when was the original color television standard was designed and implemented when? In the 50s, right? And for many, many years, and when do you think they first had the idea to transmit what's now known as HDTV? The seeds of that actually started in the 60s. When did they actually implement the HDTV standard? You know, when was that big, remember, it was in what, February of 2009 or 10 or something? What was it, 2008? Yeah, when they switched over to digital TV. Yeah, it was either like February of 2009, something like that, right? Why do you think it took them 40 years or 50 years to make that change? They what? Well, the television standard is a good example of a standard that was pretty robust, and it handled quite a bit of evolution of broadcast television. But at some point, that standard kind of ran out of gas. And they actually, much like they've done with radio, they considered making an HDTV standard that was compatible with the existing, what you now know as low-resolution television standard. That was actually one of the options that was debated. It could have been done. They chose not to do it for two reasons. One was all the people behind this push really wanted to fundamentally change the television business so they could sell everybody new television sets. And that's literally true. There was a lot of interest in rejuvenating the marketplace for television, and they felt if they stuck with the old standard that was backward compatible, HDTV wouldn't really take off. So there's a lot of momentum to actually make a fundamental shift. There were also arguments that the quality would be better if they dropped compatibility with the old standard.